guardian.co.uk.
No, I remember very well finding it quite easy writing in the first person, surprisingly easy. I was astonished when I found a first person voice that worked. I did try to write the Garrick here in the third person. And in fact, I kept about a long section of the Garrick here in the third person, which was not at all bad. I looked at it the other day, but I couldn't do it. I simply couldn't do it. And so I reverted to the first person. And then with the Millstone, it just came as a first person novel and came. The voice came quite easily.
I tried to write about it in the newspaper, perhaps rather sort of clumsily, as being a sort of odd mixture of confiding and confessional and informal, but also slightly, I don't know if stilted's the right word, but she talks in this slightly polite and proper way. Was that a kind of double effect that just came, or was it something you strive for?
I didn't strive for anything, it just happened. And it happened that way because... her voice is a strange mixture of formality and informality. I think it was the informality that made me able to write at all. I mean, I'd spent my writing career up till then writing essays and writing, at university. And to find a voice that was just a simple, narrative, informal, chatty voice was really what rescued me from writing very formal prose. But nevertheless, in me, there was somebody who could also attempt to write formal prose. And I think I just found a mix of the two. I mean, she's an academic, she's writing a thesis, so her mind naturally turns towards verbal constructions. And yet she's always undermining them herself because she's telling a story that goes absolutely against her academic life.
She has this funny mixture of, of great self-confidence in a way, and she says these things which, with a different kind of narrator, you might think, oh, I'm supposed to distrust this. So she says things like, I don't know, she says, I think I know myself better than anyone, she says, things like that. And then on the other hand, she tells you that she's so lacking in self-confidence about certain things, about how she gets on with men, what she thinks about sex, that it kind of shapes her life in this kind of extraordinary way. It's a very believable combination, but it's quite a strange combination of self-possession and self-doubt.
I suppose it's strange. I think it's probably quite common. I mean, I actually do think that being very confident in some areas and unconfident in others is not uncommon. Can I tell you a little story about Japan?
Yeah.
I mean, I was in... Japan in the 1980s, and I couldn't understand why the Japanese was so fond of this novel. It seemed mysterious to me. And I got two completely different answers, and one was that the woman in the novel was so self-confident and so outgoing and so strong as a career woman, we want to be like that in Japan. And the other was that she was so inhibited and so worried and so anxious, and we are all like that in Japan. And I thought it was very interesting that they divided her into two, and each had taken from the book what they needed for themselves.
Did you get a division of that kind amongst your English readers?
I've never heard it put like that. And I only got that response because I asked them, because I had to say something over endless meetings, why they liked it and why I was there at all. And that was the answer I got. I mean, I would never ask an English audience that. I wouldn't need to. It was a question born out of a sort of not knowing what was going on, basically.
The way I've heard people sometimes and read people sometimes talking about the narrator, the protagonist in the Millstone, is sort of whether people like her or not.
I come across that a lot, and I come across more now, 40 years on, the thing about her being privileged, which, of course, is written into the plot.
Yes.
And some young women do react with irritation to the fact that she is privileged, and I make it quite clear that I know she is, and it's about her encounter with less privilege or the boundaries of privilege. But I can see now that reading it myself, rereading it now, it is extremely annoying.
Is it, do you think?
Yes. I think she has got more than she knows she has, and it is annoying. And also the whole, we don't want to go into this too much, but the whole sort of Oxford-Cambridge certainty of life thing is very, very much of its time. Yeah. And I wouldn't write like that now. I couldn't write like that now. But that was the world she lived in, and if she's still alive, she'll be living in a different world too.
I suppose the peculiar thing is that in the novel, I mean, presumably in life, there have been people teaching her, saying, you are brilliant, this is fantastic. Yeah. But in the novel, you go to some lengths to isolate her, really, from almost everybody except us, really, reading it. Perhaps there's something slightly peculiar about that self-confidence in that you never sort of see the evidence.
That's a very interesting point. I mean, she's doing a PhD, presumably.
Yes.
And she doesn't seem to have any contact with a supervisor.
No.
but she seems quite sure that she goes off to the British Museum, that she's going along the right path.
Yeah.
I think that was possible then, and it may still be possible now. But it is true that I haven't built into the novel any sense of her academic, how she got to be where she was. It's just assumed that that's where she is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do get a little glimpse of what she might actually be doing in her PhD, sort of little, it's on Elizabethan sonnet sequences, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. and she is worrying about whether the sonnet sequence is a formality or whether it ever expresses true passion. Mm. And had I allowed her a few more pages, she could have said that she knew that Philip Sidney was expressing, Wyatt Sidney were expressing true passion, and that some of them were just copying.
Yeah.
But she doesn't have time to say all that. But she is worried about whether a literary form is only a form. This problem of quoting and referring has plagued me all my life, because obviously I've read a lot of books. I haven't read as many as some people, but I've read a lot. But I assumed that readers have also read quite a lot of books. But as I get older, I realise that some of them haven't, and that how much do you have to dissimulate knowledge? Mm. How much do you have to put quotations in quotation marks? Mm. And this is an ongoing problem for me. It's the assumptions. I've just read some very interesting short stories by Helen Simpson, and I'm very interested.
She's fantastic.
She's wonderful, but she has the courage to assume that people know certain things that they might not know, but she assumes they do, and therefore they must. Otherwise, her jokes wouldn't work, her references wouldn't work. But that whole area of literate referencing is a fascinating one.
Yeah, because I'd expected a kind of something more of a 60s, from the blurb, something more of a 60s book about choice being something you discover rather than unfreedom being something you discover.
She doesn't choose to get pregnant, but she chooses to have the baby and to keep the baby. And those were very, very significant choices, which in an earlier age, as we know, she would not have been allowed to make. She would have had the baby adopted. It would have been vanished. So she makes some decisions, but what forces her towards decision is the accident of the body. Mm. And then maternity takes over, and she has another destiny that she hadn't intended for herself. And of course, since that, this book was written pre-pill, pre-abortion law reform, it was written in the days when choices were harder. But the choices she makes are choices. So I think she is expressing freedom of a sort. She's expressing a positive freedom, which she then recognises as not what she would have designed, but what she has wanted.
Mm. You find out early in the novel that she has a child, but then she tells the story of when she discovers she's pregnant and she goes to buy gin, and she's heard that if she has a hot bath and a bottle of gin, that will get rid of it for her. And then her friends come round, so they drink the gin.
And then the bathwater goes cold.
Yes, the bathwater goes cold.
And the thing I noticed today, rereading it, was that she can't heat the bathwater up, because the water's coming out of a pilot light. Yes. And those little miserable dribbles of water. You couldn't get a hot, deep bath to have an abortion in those days. It was you couldn't fill the bath. And I thought that was very interesting. Yeah. I mean, that was full of sociological detail that I hadn't noticed at the time. But, of course, that scene comes straight out of Alan Sillitoe.
Right, I didn't, does no, it? I
yeah,
didn't
straight out of Saturday Night and Sunday right. Morning. And I'm afraid in the 50s and 60s, we all read Alan Sillitoe as a guide to do-it-yourself abortion. And I told him this once. He said, really, it wasn't a good idea. And of course, it wasn't a good idea, but I think in his novel it works, and in mine it doesn't.
It seems also a book about how people without children can't understand people with children.
I still think that. I do have a feeling that there are some areas of life that it's very hard to enter into if you don't have children, and that are utterly unavoidable and part of you if you do have children. And of course you can cross these frontiers and sympathise across it, but there is something about having children that does put you into a different place at a certain point in your life.
Yeah.
And you may be released from it eventually as you get older, but you're in it for a long time.
Well, it's a brilliant moment because it's when George comes back to the flat, yeah. Isn't he? And yeah. Of course, he doesn't know that it's actually his child.
Yeah.
And after a certain amount of conversation, she says, well, would you like to see her?
Yeah.
And he said, doesn't he say, she's beautiful.
Yeah.
Yes. That's the moment, Rosamund says. Hopeless distance.
Yeah.
Hopeless distance. So there's something a bit sort of sad about it.
Yeah, it's her fault.
Yes.
I mean, that he feels hopeless distance. She should have told him. Yeah. I always think she should have told him. And I understand why she didn't, but she should have done.
I suppose he's quite a sort of unsexy lover, isn't he, for her to have chosen.
Very, very.
Is that her choice or yours? Was that a...
That's her choice. Because she is, in fact, going out with a very sexy guy. At least I thought he was.
Which
very
one's
sexy.
The sexy
Joe,
one?
Joe Hurt.
Oh,
is Joe. A very, very sexy guy.
Not the
guy.
Despicable Roger.
No, he's not at all sexy.
Oh, right, okay.
No, he's a sort of business.
Yes.
I can't remember now if he's a barrister or an accountant, but he's a sort of very respectable figure. But Joe is a seedy, attractive guy.
And writes bad novels, which people buy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he was based on all those sort of early 60s Eat poets, mm. that kind of generation of people who went around looking shabby and attractive and ill-shaven, yes. And all that.
My favourite Joe moment, which perhaps you'll say is part of his allure, when Octavia has destroyed the novel, Joe and Lydia, who are now having an affair, are going to go off to a party, and Rosamund's wondering about how she's going to tell Lydia or how Lydia's going to react. And Joe, doesn't he say, well, can I be there when you tell her? Because it might come in useful for one of his books.
Yeah.
They're all these ghastly novelists sort of preying upon each other's unhappiness, really.
Well, I think we're always worried about writers and appropriation. And appropriating people's lives, which of course is what writers do. They have absolutely nowhere else to go but other people's lives or their own. That's what novels are about, is about people. In this novel, unlike some, I'm not appropriating anybody at all, except perhaps children, having had children. I've appropriated the act of having had children, but the children were my children were so small that they didn't notice.
So you mean there's not particular people you knew?
Absolutely not, no. So I don't feel there's anything appropriate about it, but it's obviously showing a deep anxiety about appropriation, which I think a proper novelist should feel.
The Lydia thing, you know, if you did it now, everybody would think it was a kind of wonderful postmodern trickery.
Yeah.
And Rosamund discovers Lydia's draft novel. I think it's almost my favourite bit of the book. Rosamund thinks and tells us as readers a great thing about novels, because it chimes with my interest in lots of novels. Right at the beginning, when Dick's written a novel, hasn't he, a draft novel,
yeah.
And shown it to her,
yeah.
And she says there's lots of interesting things in it, but it's totally defective in plot. And then she says, and I think it's a brilliant Rosamundish thing, which, you know, I'd go along with completely, and even worse, in time scheme. I wanted to ask you about the time scheme of your novel.
Yeah.
The first three of your novels all seem to kind of have a sort of year's span kind of thing.
Yeah?
Yeah?
It wasn't deliberate.
No.
I mean, I didn't sit down and think, I'll have a year's time span. I mean, unlike, I'm just rereading Mrs. Dalloway for various reasons. I didn't say I'll do it all in a day.
Yeah.
I didn't think that at all. And I think there's probably a much more natural reason in that it took me about a year and a half to write a novel, and a year and a half seemed about the right time span to be happening during the novel. And of course, when I got much older, I realised that you could deal with immensely long time spans, and which I now do. I deal with a lot of back history and a lot of forward projection, and it's become very much more complicated. But there was something very satisfying about writing over a year, about a year.
I sort of wondered exactly that.
Yeah, it just happened. I mean, it just so happened.
And there's a sort of, again, this is probably not something you were conscious of at the time, but something I suppose in a pedantic way I was conscious of rereading it, which is it doesn't have any chapters. It has little sort of breaks of little white bits in the for different episodes. You know, chapterless novels aren't that common. And that sort of seemed sort of part of it as well, that there was no kind of formal division. It wasn't as if the narrator come along afterwards and organised her life. It was a kind of, it was her reliving a particular passage of time.
So are chapterless novels quite unusual?
Yes, I think they're relatively rare.
That's interesting. I think I did have chapters in my first novel, but I had one or two chapters, and then my editor pointed out that they'd fizzled out. Could I put in some more? And I had quite fun thinking of some more chapter headings. But I don't think that Garrett Ears got chapter headings. I think, on the whole, I don't have chapter headings. Yeah.
Maybe it just seemed natural to do, but I think definitely for the reader, it changes. Of course, it changes the experience of reading, doesn't it? Because chapters are sort of, you know, they're the places where, you know, like Fielding said, we've stopped at an inn now. You know, so they're the places where you can switch the light off or, you know, do your Ricardo or whatever it is.
Now, it's very interesting that I, when I read, I never finish at the chapter ending. I always stop in the middle because I want to be in the middle when I pick up. And I really don't like this chapter ending coming at me and saying, oh, go and make a cup of coffee, go and do something else. I prefer, when I'm writing, it's the same. I like to write and stop when I think I know what I'm going to do next, rather than feeling everything is sectioned off into blocks and tidily stopped.
That is interesting, because you're quite a rebellious, because I'm totally obedient. So when Catherine Morland in Northanger Abbey goes to sleep, it's the end of the chapter, I close the book and switch the light off.
But you don't have to,
you know. No, I know you don't have to. You could read it all in one go.
You could. Yes, it's quite short.
It's kind of, but I suppose I would sort of call, that's my rough and ready definition of a novella. A novella is a book that you can quite easily read in one go.
Yep.
So it seems natural not to have any actual formal chapter headings. You know, I don't know. On Chesil Beach, that seems to me a novella. It's almost designed to be read in one go. It's almost narrated in one go.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But with The Millstone, you could read it in one go, but most people wouldn't, I think. So you have to make decisions about where to put it down.
It never occurred to me to have any chapters. Simply never crossed my mind. I'm trying to think if I've written any novel with deliberate chapters. And I think the answer's no.
Yeah.
I think there's one, The Witch of Exmoor, has got deliberate chapters, and that's because I thought of one or two such brilliant chapter headings that I had to work the pattern round them, and then I realised I had to segment it, because there were two chapter headings I really had to get in there, because they were diagnostic. Mm. They were sort of something I couldn't get in the prose of the book, but needed to be in the book, so they had to be either a chapter heading or an epigraph or something.
Mm.
I think I tend not to think about chapters at all. Mm. And I ignore them when I'm reading as well. So they're obviously naturally anarchic.
Yeah. Can I ask you about the ending? He says you worry too much. And he's going out of the flat. He's seen his daughter, but not found out that it's his daughter. She feels this sort of distance between them because he doesn't really know what it's like to have a child. She says, I can't help worrying. It's my nature. There's nothing I can do about my nature, is there? No, said George, his hand upon the door. No, nothing. And that's the end. That's quite a sort of emphatic feel that gives to his final statement.
Yes, it's quite a bleak ending. It's a bleak ending. And I've sometimes regretted it. It's one of, I think it's the only novel I've written where I knew the ending quite early on, and I knew it would end with this standoff situation. And I sometimes think I should have given them more space at the end, but it seemed like the right ending. But they're still very young.
Mm.
Who knows what may have happened?
I think it's time to give everybody here a chance. Now, I'm afraid we've only got one mic.
Dozens of questions I want to ask, but obviously I'm not going to. I mean, I read the book when it first came out, and reading it again made me feel quite young. I think what I want to ask you about is the movie, whether you liked it or not, and what John said about the not very powerfully sexual nature of George. He's played by Ian McKellen in the movie, isn't
yes.
he? And I think I saw Eleanor Bronn walk in as
I
well.
I think you did see another person out of the film.
So what did you think about the movie?
I thought the film was absolutely fine. I mean, I wrote the screenplay, therefore it was an excellent screenplay. We were all very young and nobody messed it about. It was directed by somebody who, in fact, I did invite here this evening, but he's in America and couldn't come. And he just did a very good job with it, I thought. I thought Ian was excellent. I thought Eleanor, who's here, was excellent. I thought the woman who played Rosamund, Sandy, was very, very good. I just thought the whole thing was of its time and of its feeling. I thought the feeling in it was true to the time.
It seems to me that the heart of the novel, or a heart of the novel, is both when she's giving birth, but especially when she is denied access to her daughter. And Rosamund certainly breaks through then with a passion and a feeling that's extraordinary. And when you remember how powerful hospitals were at that time, if you can remember what it was like, it seems awe-inspiring, her action. Was that very significant for you?
Yes, very significant. It was very much what the book was about. It was about how maternity changes you into something fiercer than you were before, and you're not going to go along and agree with what everyone tells you because it's more important than the system. But, I mean, looking back at the novel now, the system was so oppressive and women were so docile. They just took what was they were told. And I remember going through this process of having children and things fighting for them, fighting over particular incidents, and feeling that this was something one had to do. And things did change, you know, things really did change. And they're now so utterly different in hospitals with small children. And I feel that's, you know, I look round and I think the world's in a terrible state, but I do think that on some small frontiers we have made great gains.
Absolutely, and it is an important thing about Rosamund too, isn't it, that she can do that?
Yes, I mean she has the courage to do what she knows to be right when she's motivated by love, and she hasn't loved anybody very much till now, but she now knows that she loves this child and that this child's is in her hands. It's so interesting, that business about the operation, because I now realise, looking at the novel now, I think probably the operation was so serious, she would never have been allowed to take the child home so early. There would have been a frightful regime of antibiotics, and it would have been much grimmer than I portray it. It's grim enough as it is. But in fact, I went round Great Ormond Street about 3 or 4 years ago with an oncologist there who took me into the heart ward, and there was a little tiny, tiny scrap of a child who just had major heart surgery, all stitched up, looking. And this child opened its eyes and smiled at me. And I thought, well, maybe my story wasn't untrue, that, you know, this little scrap of a thing was smiling at a stranger. You smile at them, they smile back. And I just found that infinitely moving. And if you leave them to lie in their cot and don't smile at them, they don't learn to smile.
Yep. Hi, I'm writing my dissertation on your first three novels, and I was wondering if you I was wondering if you felt that there was a progression in the characters of, well, because Sarah in The Summer Birdcage is quite naive in some respects, and Emma in The Garrick is much more savvy.
Yes, they're all in the growing up process. They were all three novels were written when I was very young, but I think I was learning as I went. I mean, in a way, Emma in The Garrick Gear is more savvy than Rosamund. I mean, she's more worldly wise and more selfish, really. And Rosamund is more repressed, but, as you were saying, more in touch with her verbal self.
Can I just ask you, was it your choice to choose this novel? Or was it The Guardian's choice?
It was a mixture of the two. It was the first they suggested, and I'm so amenable that I go along with anything. But also, I was quite interested to revisit it because it's so long ago. And some of the later ones open up tremendous minefields of horror that this one doesn't at all for me. And so I'm very happy to talk about it because it was in a way an easy book with easy resolutions, although it's not wholly a happy book, but it was an easy book. So I'm happy to talk about it. And the other reason, which was purely commercial, which is that there's this very nice new edition in the Penguin Decades series, and it's in print. And I mean, not all of them are in print. So it was just somehow rather nice to celebrate it being in print. And I in fact, in October, I think it was, when this new edition came out, I was invited. It was a very funny event. In Manchester, they were doing a Penguin Decades presentation. And I hadn't been invited, you know. They'd invited one or two academics, I'm sorry to say, you know, people like that, to talk about these books. Yeah. And my ex-publisher. And there's a journalist called, is she called Lynn Barber?
She is.
She was going to be there. But she dropped out. So they emailed me and said, would you do us a tremendous favour and next Thursday go up to Manchester and talk about the Millstone? So I thought, OK, why not? It's a fascinating experience for me. I was standing in for myself, as it were, being myself. She'd gone off to do a posher interview. I know what she'd done now. But I was there. I was fascinated by two things. One was that we were in economy seats in the Manchester train, and my ticket said Lynn Barber on it. I thought, I shouldn't be so paranoid when they buy me an economy ticket instead of a first-class ticket. I thought, you know, even Lynn Barber's put in the cattle truck. And the other thing was that when we got there, you will be amused by this, John, there was an unfortunate guy, an academic,
I somehow knew that was part of the narrative.
But he had been asked to speak. He didn't know I was going, because
yes.
I wasn't meant to be there. And he was speaking about Kes, which was one of the other books in the series. And his whole beautifully structured thing was how Kes was a wonderful working class novel and the Millstone was a load of middle class rubbish. And I looked at this poor boy and I thought, oh dear. I said, I'm really sorry I'm here. And he said, well, I'll cut this bit. He was penciling bits out. And I said, look, just don't worry. I understood your brief. You understand that I'm here by mistake. And we all got on fine. And there was somebody else talking about The Clockwork Orange, who was a very clever chap, actually. So, in fact, it was a fascinating evening. But it wasn't what was meant. No, it was a... But that's why I've been talking about The Millstone this year, because it's had a little new lease of life.
We must let Margaret away. I'd just like to thank her so much for coming.
Thank you for the time. Thank you very much.